tell me about the first time that you and George Duke met. What was that meeting like?
Well, that's actually one of the funniest short stories in that in my array of short stories in my short life. Basically, I was in a hotel in Finland. It was 1971, maybe it was either the winter of 71 or it could have been like late winter, like January, February of 72. I forget. I seem to think it was 71. And I'm in this hotel, real tiny, like Finnish hotel, and I come outside of my room, and the hallways in those hotels in those days were really skimpy, really short. And I see this guy way down at the end of this hallway, and he's got on this huge, like dashiki African thing, and he has this huge afro, and he's got this bag, like the guys back then had these shoulder bags, and he had an African shoulder bag. So I came out, and I had one of those triple afros. My thing was really huge, man. I could take up a whole Volkswagen, you know.
A la Julius Erving.
Yeah, I think mine was bigger than his, actually. Oh. It was huge, man. So we come out, he's walking down the hall, I'm going the other way, and we're going toward each other, and I'm telling you, man, it sounds funny, but we could barely pass each other because of the hair. And we just kind of cracked up. It was just like a funny, you know, it was a funny thing, you know. So he said to me, you know, we were really young. I was like, gosh, I don't know how old I was, 20 maybe?
20, 21?
Something like that, you know, and he was a little bit older, you know, and he says, you're Stanley Clark. I said, yeah. I said, you're George Duke, you know, because, you know, back in those days, there was the West Coast jazz musicians and the East Coast jazz musicians. It wasn't like the rappers, you know, where they were shooting each other because of that. It was just different. It was a much more of a, there was a distinct sound. They were out here in California, the sound was more like kind of dreamy, the softer.
And you were in Philly.
Yeah, I was in Philly, and I had moved to New York, and so it was hard-edged. And so we met, and I think he was playing with Cannibal Adderley. I was playing in a band with Chick Corea. And we met and became really cool friends after that, and just we always crack up about that that thing, you know. And he, you know, he always says, I didn't have a shoulder bag. I said, yes, you did.
Interesting that you bring up the differences in the musical styles. And as you know, I mean, they say opposites attract. Did you guys hit it off musically right away, too?
Yeah,
that kind of
right
thing?
Right away. Yeah. I mean, we, from that day on, it started a musical relationship that's been going on to this day. You know, George is one of my favorite musicians to play with. He's, you know, he's one of these guys that, you know, not like a bad bone in this person. You know, he's like one of the kindest dudes you could ever meet, you know, and smart, really smart, and a tremendous musician. He's the kind of a guy that can do like 9 different things all at the same time. I mean, he could totally, you know, handle all the music for the Grammys, write it out, rehearse it with all the bands, do that, go play a jazz gig, or then go play an R&B gig, or he can produce anybody, anything, anywhere, singer, instrumentalist, whatever. And then he's a good writer, you know, he has his own music that he does that he's done throughout the years. I mean, he's a very, like, very, very talented, like, individual. You know, there's a lot of stuff that he does that people just because of the nature, you know, usually when a musician is a kind of a, you know, he's out front, but he's also behind the scenes type of a person, you know, the general public doesn't see that kind of stuff. But some of his strongest efforts in music have been behind the scene, meaning the records that he's produced, the shows that he's been a musical director on, like really difficult stuff, you know. Mm. And, he's doing something with the Kennedy Center, the Monk Institute or something like that. Did a lot of different type of artists, a very complicated musical direction kind of gig. So, You know, he's definitely, you know, one of my top three favorite musicians.
And you guys are not out together all the time, and years go by sometimes between gigs with him, and it seems like you guys pick it up right where you left it off.
Yeah. Well, we kind of made it was kind of a unspoken, but we, you know, we started back up again, and I think we're going to just do more things because it's easy now. You know, we can, like, say, okay, hey, let's go out for a week here, or let's go out for a couple weeks there, or hey, let's go do this, or let's go that. It's nice because when we gear up, it's pretty easy, and you know, we have a lot of music to choose from. It's a lot of fun. And that's really what it's about. You know, the fun part is cool. It's rare, you know, when you're around, you know, a musical situation that's very high level where you have that much fun. You know, it's rare.
Tell us a little bit about the gig coming up here at the Indy Jazz Fest tomorrow. I know on the web you promised funky, but I know this, that you're playing some of the acoustic stuff too, which is very cool.
Yeah, we do a nice thing in the middle of the show, you know, because, you know, along with the regular Clark Duke music, you know, one of the thing that's actually at our core is that we are jazz musicians. No matter what we've played or will play, you know, at the core of what we do is we're jazz musicians. That's how George grew up. That's how I grew up. And so right in the middle of the show, we give the audience like a taste of what it was like when we were growing up, some of the songs we wanted to learn. You know, like lately we've been doing a tune, Autumn Leaves, you know, which is, I think I learned that tune when I was 14 or 15. And we do just me and George on acoustic piano, me on acoustic bass, and people really, really, really like it because it's real. You know, it's like it's something that we did. I think maybe they can, even if there's people out there that maybe never heard a lot of traditional jazz music, they could just heard George's funky stuff or my whatever. You know, they can appreciate it because that music is classic, and you know, you present it in such a way where people understand. I usually give a little spiel about it, talk a little bit about it, and people see that it's you know, they can probably picture, you know, myself at 15, George at 18 or whatever. You know, and it's you know, that's what we did back then, and that's what that foundation is what made us who we are. You know, so we do that. We do some of our other music from all our records. The problem is at this point in our life is that there's so many things to play. It's really difficult to figure out, like, well, you know, what are we going to do? And, oh, God, we can't do that because, you know, we can only do so many songs on a set. I mean, we'd have to play straight for a couple months, everything, and we'd end up in the hospital. So.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would mind hearing you guys play for that long in a row. You know, I want to ask you this. I mean, you've won Grammy Awards. You've scored films, television programs, big arenas, small little clubs. In fact, tonight you're out with Hiromi, and then on Sunday I think you're out with Hiromi as well. And playing with Chick still and Jack DeJohnette, some legends. At this point in your career, what brings you the most satisfaction in what you're doing?
You know, the most satisfaction to me is great. It doesn't really matter so much who I play with. I love playing with good musicians. But what I really like is playing really good music with people that are very appreciative of it. I'm speaking of other musicians, you know. You know, it's easy sometime to, you know, continue to play music and it sort of becomes like, oh yeah, I'm just doing my job or something like that. But it's actually more than a job. I mean, it's you know, music does a lot of things for people. You know, it's very healing. Sometimes people come to the show and they come in there with their residue from the day, and if your energy up on the stage is very cool, you have to, like, before you can get other people to be grateful about something, you have to be grateful about it. You know, they have to sense that you think that this is something special, And that's one another thing that I like about George. George is he's a very passionate musician. You know, he really means what he's playing. He's not just playing it. He really means it. You know, and so this comes across, and I think that's why George has had a long, long career, and he'll play till he drops, like myself. You know, mm-hmm. you have to really mean what you're doing out there when you're an artist, and that's just not in music. It can be in painting, it can be in literature. It could be, you have to give people that sense that you know that you're not faking.
Well, I've got to tell you that I am one of many bass players who counted you as an influence when I was growing up and learning how to play. But I'm curious to know, when you were growing up as a young kid, just picking up the bass, who were your influences? Who did you listen to? Who did you say, man, I want to play like that guy?
Yeah, my influences, it was really easy. I mean, Ron Carter was there. He was, you know, I liked Ron Carter because of his steadiness, you know. Seemed like, and it actually later when I met him, personality is exactly like his playing. He's just a very steady, like he's almost like a high school principal or something. You know, you wonder when you get around him, you go, Ron, is everything all right? You know, he's
yeah.
looking at you pretty heavy, but he's a nice guy underneath all that, and he's great. And matter of fact, his birthday was this year. He's 75, and I'm actually giving him a bass for his birthday. Me and Lenny White, we had this bass made for him.
Cool.
To deliver it to him next week in New York. And yeah, Ron is one of my favorites. I also liked Scott LaFaro, who played with
Bill Evans.
Yeah. I also liked an unusual bass player, which was Richard Davis. Because he was so crazy, played with Thad Jones and Mel Lewis, and made a lot of recordings and electric bass players. I actually go all the way back to remember hearing Paul McCartney and the Beatles,
mm-hmm.
hearing James Jamerson. I'm actually am a fan of a lot of different players and people. And then, of course, just my favorite musicians that I listen to were probably John Coltrane and Miles Davis.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about your sound, because someone listens to a Stanley Clark or a Clark Duke project, CD, something that you've played with Return to Forever, or just about anybody else. I mean, one of my favorite CDs, by the way, is the one with McCoy Tyner and Al Foster from a few years ago. That's terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But especially on the electric, people identify that sound immediately as Stanley Clark. And I'm curious about when you kind of discovered that sound. I mean, was there an aha moment, or did that kind of evolve into something that became signature Stanley Clark?
I think I didn't really think too much about it. You know, I had pretty much of a... My career as a bass player has been like a kind of a fairy tale kind of thing. I'm great. There's talent, and some of it was just kind of luck, kind of things just happen because it's just the way it is. I mean, when I started playing, I just played the electric bass the way I thought it should be played. And I really didn't really, and this is true about me and the bass and for the bass in general. I never really defined myself as a bass player. I was very fortunate when I was very young that a great musician that just passed away, his name was Bayard Lancaster, that lived in my neighborhood, was much older than us, you know, and he told us, you know, never let the instrument define you. You define the instrument, you know, define what you're doing. And so I just played whatever I felt like playing on the instrument at the way I felt like playing it. And I was lucky I didn't get fired from too many gigs, but I did get fired from some gigs. Like I said, well, this guy is way too wild.
No kidding.
You know, what is that sound? What the hell is that? You know, so... So, but you know, I was very fortunate. And then when people in the masses embraced what I did, You know, that always, you know, that justifies, you know, how every musician defines himself when he's, you know, appreciated and people like what he's doing, you know. So I just did that when I started making records. It kind of solidified it even more, and it's just the way I play. You know, the instrument helps too, the Olympic bass, you know, and it's just what it is, you know. It's just what I do is kind of what I do, and you know, it's really interesting because when you talk, there's certain guys that are stylists, certain types of instrumentalists that. Like, you know, like one of my favorite guitar players is Jeff Beck, you know, rock guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being is because, you know, he really has a really distinctive style. And it's nothing scientific about it. It's not like he's not even that kind of a person, you know, to sit down and I'm going to scientifically come up with my own style, you know. It's just the way it came. He doesn't play with a pick because mm-hmm. he never learned how to do it. So he's hitting it with the nail on his thumb. He holds a pick, but he rarely uses it, and he hits it with his thumb. And
I think he plays with talcum powder all over his right hand too, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got some weird stuff, you know. Cause, you know, he's a car mechanic, so he you know, when he, every time I've been to his house, he's like, he's got a collection of all these roadsters, old roadsters. He's under there. He's a grease monkey. Like, comes out looking like strange, and he'll just pick up a guitar and that's it. And so his sound comes from him. It's like it's him. It's what it is, you know. And you know, if you asked him why did you know, he's not going to say, you know. Jeff has never said to me, like, well, I do it because of this or that. It just is. It's just the way he is, you know. So it's the same for me, you know, and a lot of others that, you know, it's just it's nothing special. But then it is, you know. It's lucky that I was able to come up with something that's natural, that people associate with me. It's sad because that's what it is, you know.
Tell me a little bit about your foundation, which has been up and running for, what, 10 years or maybe a little bit more, giving kids a chance to get involved with music as a profession and some scholarships that you're giving out.
Yeah, I've been doing this for quite some time, 10 years. Basically, me and my wife, we raise money for kids to give them scholarships. We do it quietly, you know. We have a concert every year, and we call different celebrities to come in, and, you know, we raise some money, and we send kids to school. It's something that's near dear to my heart. You know, I think it's important, you know, higher education, any sort of higher education, but in music, you know, there's a lot of kids out there that, you know, the economic times are rough, and there's some kids out there that just quite frankly can't afford to either continue with college or go to college, so we help out. And it's pretty much that simple, you know. It's a lot of fun the way we do it. You know, there are a lot of applicants that apply for the scholarship, and you know, we narrow it down to, you know, maybe 7 or 8, and then we have a performance that's much like American Idol or something.
Mm-hmm.
And kids come up, and it's like Battle of the Bands, and you know, so it's so interesting. The last couple of years, it's always been like a lot of the bands come on, but it's one instrumentalist. Like, there was this one guy that came in, and matter of fact, it's the guy that's playing with me and George. We actually hired him.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's a funny story there. I mean, but it's true. His name is Henry McDaniels, and he can't be more than 20 years old, this kid. And what happened was there were all these bands, killer bands, playing. And this guy just came up on the stage, and we didn't know what the hell he was going to do. And he just said, well, I'm going to play a drum solo. And that was it. And he was just better than all the other guys. You know, the bands and rock bands, and they had lights and this and that. You know, but this guy just came up with a simple drum set. There was no, you know, bells and whistles, and he just played a drum solo and grooved for a little while.
Yeah.
Wasn't just all notes. He just got up there and played a groove for a second.
Hmm.
And he was really killing, and so he won.
That's awesome. One kid wins the battle of the bands, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Real quickly about your Alembic basses. I know you had a long relationship with Alembic and may have been the first guy that really put them on the or helped put them on the map.
Right.
What was it? I know Jimmy Johnson is another favorite bass player of mine. He uses Alembics exclusively.
He's my favorite bass player that plays Alembic bass.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely my favorite.
He is phenomenal. Everything, man, it's just... I wish there was more of him on the web, but there's not a whole lot of him out there. But
that's right.
In any case, what was it that drew you to the Alembic bass and began that long relationship with which continues today?
It was kind of by default. You know, I was playing this Gibson EBO bass, which was back in the old days, 71. It was horrible sound I was getting out of that thing. I don't know what I was doing, but it was just muddy and mumbly, and I just couldn't get it right, you know. Maybe I didn't, the bass amp combination didn't work, strings, I don't know, it just sounded bad, you know. And so this guy who built the Alembic bass, Rick Turner, came to the show, he was very young, and he says, you know, man, you really play good, man, but your sound is terrible, horrible. I wanted to hit the guy, man. I said, this is this guy, man. You know, he says, but, he says, before you hit me, I got something in the car I want you to check out. So he brings in this bass. It was probably one of the first 10 Alembics made. And he gave it to me, and it was like a transformation. It was I can't even explain to you. All of a sudden, I could hear what I was playing. You know, and it was clear as a bell. It was the first time that kind of hi-fi electronics, and they were really on the cutting edge of electronics and instruments at that time. And it worked great for the bass. It wasn't that great for guitars because it was too clean, their guitars. But the basses, it was incredible. And so I told the guy, he thought I was crazy. I gathered up all the money I could get, and I think he was coming back another night, and I just took the bass from him, gave him, I think it was $1,600, which was a ton of money at the time for an instrument. I mean, that's like paying 10 grand a day. I mean, you'd buy an electric bass for $200 back then, you know. It just
And get a good one.
And get a really good one. I mean, you get like a you know, P-bass, jazz, you know, really nice one. So I gave him this money because he said it was like, I don't know, $1,800. That's how much I put in it to build it. You know, that was his prototype or whatever. And I just said, man, I got to have it. He said, I know you have another one at home. He goes, yeah. So he sold it, and that was that. And I kept that bass. I made probably the first records I made with that. I kept that bass until someone stole it, and it's great.
Wow. It's interesting you said play what you're hearing, or you hear what you're playing, but I think also it goes like you hear this music in your head, and now you're able to hear it come out of the bass, you know?
It's one of the coolest things, I think, out of all the instruments, the whole list of instruments that are out there in the world. I think that the electric bass, even totally the electric bass, I really believe it is the instrument that has improved in a quantum leap compared to other instruments, because it went from not only just the sound but the psychology that's connected with the instrument. I mean, in my days when I was first coming up, I mean, you were a bass player, you know, when I was 14 or 15 or 13, I forget how old I was, you know, you see Bill Wyman with the Rolling Stones on TV looking like, you know, he can't wait for the song to be over, you know. Please get me out of here. Who is this guy, Ed Sullivan? Why am I here? You know, I'll never forget that. I remember saying to my sister, what is this guy? He's got a bass. He looks like he's really upset, you know. But it went from that kind of behind the scenes, standing in the back, you know, nobody really noticing you.
Can't hear you.
You know, the instrument was not quite right. They didn't really have it together yet, the sonics. To you know, being able to hear everything you can play. I mean, you know, myself, even coming up to James Jamerson's time, I mean, it got better. When Jaco came on the scene, harmonics, you can hear things. I mean, all kinds of things you can hear whatever you want on the bass, you know. You got hybrid, like piccolo basses, tenor basses, all that kind of stuff. And then the psychology part is you got guys standing in front of bands, you know.
Exactly.
Playing and making records. I mean, I tell you, I can't even tell you. I have a box for records from bass players, and I haven't went through and listened to all of them yet. I must have 1,000 of these things, man. All over the world, bass players are making records. And in schools, you actually now can go to school and study the electric bass. That was a no-no when I came up. There was one book by Carol Kaye, and that had all whole notes in it.
Exactly, yeah. I had that book.
Yeah, there's nothing in that book. You aren't going to learn nothing in that book. Maybe the open strings and a few other notes, and that's it.
Yeah.
But now you actually study the instrument, and you study it's like studying violin or studying saxophone or whatever. So it's a really it's finally a legitimate instrument, and the study is legitimate, and guys go to school to learn how to do that and go out and play and hopefully make money, you know, professionally. So it's a good day for the bass, finally, you know.
Yep.
I only wish Jaco was here, because we used to talk about that. I only wish he was around, yeah, you know, to experience that, you know, because it was good when he came on the scene. It kind of legitimized myself, and so we didn't all seem so crazy, all this wild bass players, you know.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, you have done a whole lot to take the bass to the level at which it resides right now. So you deserve a lot of credit for that. And, hey, you know, it's going to be great to hear you and George on Saturday. Can't wait for that. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us
this
morning.
Great, man. Take care, and thanks. And I'll talk to you if you get a chance. If you're there, come backstage, man. Say hello. All right?
Yeah, will do, man. Thanks very much.